Good afternoon, may it please the court. My name is Sean Lacefield, attorney registration number 35703, and I represent Mr. Carnes. This afternoon, I'd like to speak with the court about why the standard of review, the record, and the controlling case law allow this court to reverse the trial court's order denying Mr. Carnes' petition and reverse with an order directing the court, the trial court, to seal these records. Bushu and RJZ provide the boundaries outside of which a trial court's wide discretion becomes an abuse of discretion in this sort of case. Here, just as in RJZ, the trial court misapplied certain factors and made findings that are manifestly against the evidence as to the other factors. First, in terms of the seriousness of the offense, in RJZ, the court states, in a total context, the fact that the charges of which the petitioner was acquitted were serious increases the potential harm to him if the records were not sealed. Here, the context is a dismissal due to no reasonable likelihood of success. In RJZ, the court talked about cases in which an individual was acquitted or there was dismissal due to a suppression, a motion to suppress being granted.
Whose language is no reasonable chance of success? Is that your interpretation or did the trial court actually use those words?
That is my quote from the people. The district attorney at the record sealing hearing said that there was no reasonable likelihood of success had the case proceeded to trial, and that was the reason for the dismissal in this case. Which distinguishes it from the cases that are mentioned in RJZ that talk about a motion to suppress being granted that excludes otherwise meritorious evidence, or, for instance, possibly a speedy trial violation where you have a meritorious case that is ready to proceed to trial, but due to no fault or no issue with that evidence, the case doesn't proceed to trial and you have otherwise meritorious evidence that is lapsed. Here we have a case where much, if not most, of the people's case was presented at two pretrial hearings, which led to the court determining that the child was not competent to testify, and that 6 out of 12 child hearsay statements would not be admissible.
Mr. Lightsfield, is it your position then that the trial court shouldn't have considered that factor at all?
Which, the seriousness of the
defense?
I think the question becomes whether it can be distinguished in this case from RJZ. I think that those factors are, I don't think that the case law says that those factors cannot be considered one way or the other in any particular case. It depends on how they can be considered. So for instance, in RJZ it says in an acquittal context, the seriousness of the offense cannot weigh against granting the petition. So when you take that analysis from RJZ and apply it to this case where we have a dismissal due to no reasonable likelihood of success, there is no factual or legal distinction between this case and RJZ that allow the trial court to say, here it is appropriate for me to take the serious allegations and weigh them against Mr. Carnes' petition to seal his records.
How do you deal, though, with the difference that in an acquittal, you have a fact finder actually saying, either having met the burden of proof or we don't believe these witnesses, whereas here, it's not that the evidence that the kid is lying, it's just that, as a matter of law, the kid's incompetent. Never going to get up on the stand. What is the legal effect of that as opposed to what you had in the RJZ case?
What we have here, Your Honor, is a case that is final for all intents and purposes. If this case is going to be refiled, it is going to be refiled as a result of new evidence that is developed. And that evidence is not present at this time. It was not presented to the trial court in this case. There was no affidavit to the trial court stating there has been a factual development since we filed a motion to dismiss, stating that there was no reasonable likelihood of success had this case proceeded to trial. So I can't imagine a scenario in which it would be ethically appropriate for a prosecutor to refile this case absent some factual development. In that case, we have a different case. We have different evidence from which the trial court, or a court addressing a petition to seal records, can assess the strength of the case or the seriousness of the charges. That we don't have here. So for all intents and purposes, we have a final determination on the evidence as it exists at this time.
But why can't you conceive a situation if the kid is older, and for that reason alone becomes competent, why couldn't the prosecutor say, okay, the victim is now competent to testify, let's hear what they have to say?
Because it necessarily involves speculation as to what the child will say and testify to when she's older, when she's competent. Will her opinion of what took place have changed? Will the context of those statements have changed based on her experiences and the things that she's learned since the time that those statements were initially made? So it goes into a great degree of speculation as to what the child will testify to upon reaching competency. The child could just as easily decide that she was misled or that something was inaccurate or basically reach the opposite conclusion that the people felt that she had drawn upon obtaining competency.
So your argument, if I understand it, and the comparison to RJC, is that you're in a better position than RJC. Correct me if it's wrong. I think you're saying to us that you're in a better position than an acquittal because you didn't get the trial because the prosecutor decided there wasn't enough evidence. So you didn't even have the chance to get an acquittal. That's basically your argument, right?
Essentially, yes. I don't see any factual or legal distinction between a case that proceeds to trial and accordingly gets past a preliminary hearing, gets past a motion for judgment of acquittal, and an RJZ. I believe there were 12 of the 25 charges that made it to the jury. And it only really mainly speaks to the extraordinary burden of proof that we have there. So here, the prosecution decided this is a case when we take the evidence that is remaining to us, and the other evidence was excluded because it did not meet such minimal pretrial thresholds to allow a jury to even consider it fairly when deciding Mr. Karn's guilt or innocence. The remaining evidence does not present even a reasonable likelihood of success. So I'm not suggesting that this court has to or should articulate any broader rule than what applies in this case, which is a dismissal due to no reasonable likelihood of success, as stated by the prosecution. I recognize that there are a number of other potential reasons to dismiss that don't speak to this issue and don't really wrestle with the strength of the people's case, but that's not what we have here.
Mr. Lisa, let me tell you what's, just be straight up, what's bothered me a bit about your argument, I'd like you to address it. Obviously, the district court has a lot of discretion here. The district court, you make very compelling arguments, and you've got a lot of equities on your side, but the district court did go through every factor and made findings and announced them and weighed them, and I'm just concerned about where we sit as an appellate court based on the standard of review, how we're not bound by those findings. I understand you say at least the seriousness of the charge was a legal error, so that's an abuse of discretion. Can you address that a little bit more? It just feels to me like we're being asked to reweigh what the district court did, and that causes me some concern.
The trial court does go through extensive findings in this case. He talks about a number of things from the current harm that has been suffered to, he talks about future adverse consequences, which he describes as patently obvious and acute. And this is where it's critical. A misapplication of the law is an abuse of discretion, and the trial court provides this court a window within which to see how it applied this court's opinion in Bushu when it gets to the adverse consequences analysis. And even though it makes findings that there are patently obvious, acute, adverse consequences that Mr. Karnes will suffer if he should need to apply for anything that would require a background check in the future. And this is where I quote from the trial court, the bottom line in Bushu clearly states what has been the prejudice that Mr. Karnes has suffered. And then he talks about present adverse consequences. A friend is providing him a place to live at the moment. He is employed. So despite mentioning these future adverse consequences, when he says, okay, now it is time for me to apply this court's opinion in Bushu to the facts and my findings in this case, it necessarily excludes from the weighing, from the balancing that he is required to engage in to appropriately apply that abuse of discretion or that wide discretion that he has afforded. He's saying, I don't look to those future adverse consequences under Bushu. And I think that that's also inconsistent with the plain language of the statute.
Did the court really say it was excluding those, or did the court just say, I've got to weigh them and I put more weight on the fact that he hasn't had any present prejudice?
He does not say, I am excluding those from my analysis. What he says is the bottom line in Bushu clearly states what has been the prejudice that Mr. Karnes has suffered. So he's basically saying, here is the question that Bushu requires me to answer. And it requires me to look at what is the prejudice that he has suffered. And along those lines, he sets an evidentiary bar that Mr. Karnes is not required to meet. He talks about the fact that Mr. Karnes has a place to live, while the evidence was that Mr. Karnes was sleeping on a friend's sofa, watching his house while he was commuting to work for a job that he had just obtained. He talks, the trial court said, well, he hasn't suffered complete social ostracism. He still has a friend who is willing to extend him a helping hand. This is not the standard that a petitioner asking to seal records is required to meet, that he showed that he suffered complete social ostracism. So he gives this court the window within which to see his Bushu analysis when he says, the bottom line. So the critical inquiry in Bushu requires me to look at what has been the prejudice that Mr. Carnes has suffered. I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lacefield. Mr. Lee?
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee on behalf of People Bar number 38141. The magistrate's ruling should be affirmed because the record confirms that the court carefully considered the relevant factors in its 20-paragraph oral ruling denying petitioner's petition to seal. To overturn the judgment, petitioner must establish that the court abused its discretion. As this court has noted, and as the case has said in the briefs made clear, it's not enough for petitioner to show that a different court could have reasonably reached a different judgment. He must show that the magistrate reached an order that is manifestly arbitrary, unreasonable, or unfair. Now, I think there are two arguments that petitioner has put before the court today. The first is that the magistrate abused his discretion by considering the severity of the offense. In petitioner's view, it is wrong as a matter of law for the court to consider the severity of the offense when the people dismiss the case. The second argument is that the court abused its discretion by failing to consider the future consequences petitioner might suffer if the court decided not to seal the records. The first argument fails as a matter of law, the next fails as a matter of fact. Beginning with the first, I'd like to begin with the statutory text, if I may. And the statute we're dealing with says that in reviewing petition to seal, a court must balance the public's interest against the privacy interests of the petitioner and the first consequences he or she might face. So whatever specific factors are considered, one of the two principal considerations will always be the public's interest in the records. And by any measure, the public's interest is inextricably intertwined with the type and nature of the crime that the records relate to.
But what, and so I'm troubled by this one. Tell me what evidence there was of a public interest. I recognize there are allegations here that the people decided not to pursue, but just the fact that there are allegations doesn't seem to me to create a public interest as a matter of law. The allegations could be totally false or unfounded. I'm concerned where you draw that line. Because you say just that there are allegations, therefore that public has an interest, even if that would apply even after an acquittal. So where's the public interest in knowing about charges that were the prosecution dismissed because they didn't feel they could prove them?
I agree that there is absolutely a line, and I think the magistrate here correctly followed it. The preparatory question before considering whether or not the severity of the charges should be considered is what the magistrate did in this case.
Okay, I want to hold you on. You didn't answer my question. What's the public interest here?
Well, it's the severity of the offense, but I'm saying the preparatory issue to that is whether or not there's sufficient evidence in the court's judgment, as it was in this case, that sufficient evidence supported the charges. So if there is sufficient evidence, and the magistrate did detailed findings, it went through the affidavit, it looked at the statements and determined that there was probable cause for the charges.
Well, that was before the petition to seal, right?
I mean, it was before, and the magistrate did his own independent review. In detailed findings, looking through the affidavit, the judge went through and said that although certainly some of the statements we found unreliable undercut some of the other statements, that the other statements that were found admissible alone were sufficient to justify the charges. So if there's a sufficient evidentiary basis for the charges, then certainly the public has an interest in the crime, and most importantly, in the kind of crime that the records relate to. And while petitioner is correct that RGZ did recognize a slight, carved out a small exception to this rule when a person is acquitted, there's an absolute difference between a final judgment on the merits that a trial court cannot supplant its own view versus a case where the people dismiss the case, and the key, I think, is without prejudice, where there no judgment has been entered at all.
So can the people file an information that lists a whole bunch of charges, recognizing when they filed it, I don't know, it's maybe a close call, have a preliminary hearing, then decide to dismiss, and forevermore we can keep that on the record? I mean, there seems to be severe prejudice to the defendant in that situation.
Well, I would disagree with forevermore. It's just the issue of whether or not a court could consider in some cases that the record should remain public. And I think the key is we really are limited by statute that says the court has a discretion whether or not to seal it. We're not dealing with a mandatory statute where it says that if the court finds that there's a privacy interest the petitioner will be harmed, the court must seal the record. It says specifically that a court has the discretion to weigh whether or not the public's interest is outweighed by the petitioner's privacy interest and other warning consequences that might follow by not sealing the record.
So let me follow up on that then, because one of the other factors apparently is the time frame. So here, if my recollection is correct, you had like 3 months. The petition was filed 3 months after, I guess, the dismissal. So, I mean, how does that play in? I mean, if a year goes by or 2 years, what's the deadline where that factor then becomes so much more important?
I think it's case specific. In a case like this, where the charges were dismissed based on the child being found incompetent, I mean, certainly the short time frame supports the court's judgment because we don't know whether or not the charges are going to be refiled. For example, when the child gets older, the child might be found to be competent to testify, and the charges will be refiled.
Would you agree that the petitioner could file a petition again? I mean, he's not barred from filing another petition, is he?
I don't believe so, and the magistrate specifically found in its final conclusion that he was not entitled to sealing at this time.
How long does he have to wait?
I would say the longer the period goes and charges are not refiled, the more it would weigh in his favor. But certainly, and in this case, the petition was filed 2 months and a day after the charges were dismissed. Given the circumstance we have here where the child was found incompetent to testify because she was 6 years old, that the short time frame certainly favors the magistrate's ruling that was in the public's interest to keep the records public, because we don't know whether or not the child will be deemed competent to testify at a later date.
And Mr. Lee, could you just focus a little bit on the argument of Mr. Carnes that the magistrate did not properly consider future adverse consequences?
Absolutely. I think this court looks at page 18 of the transcript of trial court's ruling, and I think even if petitioner's counsel cited the court's record, the court said it was patently obvious the harm that petitioner would suffer, that he was not going to belabor the point, because it's clear that having something like this on the record is obviously going to adversely affect someone's records. So to the extent that the court later focused on petitioner's present harm, which I don't think is disputed, it's not disputed that that's a relevant factor to consider. It wasn't doing it at the exclusion of the future harm that the petitioner would face. So I think it's clear in the court's order on page 18, I'm sorry. And then in the court's written order on page 15 of the electric record, the court also stated the factors it was going to look at before at the hearing, and the petitioner's future consequences is one of the things listed. But I think if you look through the thing, it's very clear that the court considered the future consequences that petitioner would suffer. And I would like to make one distinction between on the future consequences between this case and RJZ. In RJZ, the petitioner, the person seeking to have the records in that case, was a teacher who wanted to be a principal. It's pretty clear based on that case that the prejudice he would suffer in having a sex assault on his record that he'd been acquitted of would adversely affect his employment circumstances. In this case, we had a real estate broker who was fired because of the charges, but then also got another job as a real estate broker. But I think there's a real difference in future prejudice between a teacher with these charges on their record versus a real estate broker.
Well, doesn't a real estate broker go into people's homes?
They would be access
to kids in the same situation, I would think.
I'm not trying to mitigate that it doesn't adversely affect someone for any job. I'm just saying I think a teacher is a unique, I think they suffer unique prejudice in this regard.
I understand. I think there was you listed two arguments you wanted to respond to, and I think there was a third one that I would like your response to. Mr. Lacefield indicates that the court kind of said there wasn't complete social ostracism, which suggests at least, arguably, that the court was applying a pretty high standard. Could you respond to that argument as well, Mr. Lee?
Yeah, I don't think the court was saying that that was the bar, that in order to prove or in order to give Zerkin CLK to prove that he's socially ostracized. I think the court was just saying that to the extent obviously, petitioner suffers from the records not being sealed some level of social ostracism. But the court also found a mitigating that it had specific evidence in front of it that there was some mitigating evidence before it. I mean, and also in the employment context and the fact that he had a job. And I think I'd segue that into just kind of summing up how this case is distinct from RJZ. Because although I think this case does present a very different set of factual circumstances, I think in both cases, both there and here, the same controlling analysis applies. It's whether the magistrate's findings are supported by the record. And in this case, the findings the magistrate made were directly supported by the record. Two ways in which, in RGZ, for example, two of the reasons the trial court cited for not serving the records were that the court found that there's an ongoing investigation in that case, and that the and also cited the strength of people's case. On review, the division of RGZ found that there was no basis to support either of those claims. Of course, in this case, the prosecutor made similar assertions, but there's absolutely a factual basis for those claims. The prosecutor stated that there was a possibility that future charges might come back. In this case, the very evidence that supported filing charges in the first place provides sufficient basis for the magistrate to conclude that that was a possibility. With respect to the strength of the government's case, the magistrate specifically looked at the affidavit and said that after a very thorough review, that he found that there was enough in there to support the charges of the first instance. So because the trial court's findings are supported by the record, we ask you to affirm. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
So, Eastfield. Okay. 4 minutes and 41 seconds, I believe.
Thank you. There's a point in the court's findings here that is strikingly similar to RJZ. In RJZ, there was talk by the prosecutor at the record sealing hearing about possible additional new charges that were going to be filed against RJZ and why this was an important factor that the court should consider when weighing against the petition of seal. The prosecutor here made the statements that have already been discussed, so hopefully we will be able to file this again. These are purely speculative statements, no less so than the prosecutor's statements in RJZ. And the trial court really latched onto this. The trial court made findings that talked about the merits of this are really broader than the evidence that that was presented at the motions hearing. So it's placing some fairly significant weight on the prosecutor's subjective assessment of the case and personal assessment of the case and the speculation about how it may or may not change in the future. The court asked about the possibility of refiling this case, and this is I don't know if it's necessarily clear in Mr. Kern's case. There was the opinion, I believe it's MTB People, that said that because the record sealing statute does not address the petitioner's ability to refile, the common law rule of claim preclusion or res judicata would apply. Now, what complicates that in this case is there is a pretrial order that the magistrate issued that said that if the petition was denied on the merits and the factual circumstances changed over time, that the petitioner would be able to refile. So the court has that to. If the court is considering that in its analysis in this case, I think that's something that the court will have to wrestle with. The short time frame between acquittal and the petition for to seal NRJZ was also rejected by the Court of Appeals as a factor that would weigh against granting a petition to seal those records. And I don't see how Mr. Karn's case is distinguishable. The court asked about the significance of the Mr. RJZ being a teacher or in education compared to Mr. Carnes, who was in real estate. It also isn't uncommon for a real estate agent, especially in commercial real estate, to have to bid for jobs. And those bids for jobs are going to involve background checks. So in order to get, I mean, he may be employed by a real estate agency where, in theory, he can go out and find employment, but if he has to bid for jobs, each one of those jobs that comes back with a background check and finds these allegations, it's going to be harming him. I would also point out that the affidavit, which the Attorney General references, it is apparently handed to the magistrate at some point during the proceeding. He apparently reads from it at certain points during his findings, but it is not offered as an exhibit. It is not admitted into evidence according to the record. It is not a part of the record from which this court can exercise its judicial review. In recognizing the standard of review in this case, deference from this court to the trial court does not imply an abandonment or an abdication of judicial review. And that is where the boundaries of RJZ and Bushu provide guidance to this court in its review of this case. And we would ask the court to reverse the trial court and remand for sentencing.
Thank you, Mr. Laysfield. Thank you again, Mr. Lee. I appreciate the briefs and excellent arguments to counsel. They, too, were very helpful to the court. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.